This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome again. Well, we're going to talk today, Jackie, about the Globe 2020 conference in Vancouver. That's the largest, longest running sustainable business conference in the world.
Yeah, and you just came back from it.
I think it's inescapable that we again have to talk about the coronavirus.
Yeah, we haven't actually talked about that on the podcast, but we did write about it, but we'll give an update on what it means for oil and gas markets.
We do, and update on the crude by rail in Western Canada, all the way from the blockades to the slowdowns in speed. And also, we got the news that the Alberta government has sold some of the rail contracts that were previously purchased by the Alberta government under Rachel Notley's premiership. And then finally, we're going to talk a few minutes about the Enbridge, still pushing forward with the plans to contract the mainline.
Right. And there was recently some letters sent to the regulator. So give everyone an update on
that. Lots of topics, no shortage of topics. The Globe 2020 conference, as I said, that's the longest running sustainable business summit and innovation showcase in North America. Basically, it's a sustainability conference that's been, I don't know when it started, but I don't know. I've been going there for
1990.
I think I first started going in the year 2000. And it attracts people from almost every country in the world, I think 97 countries. Well, okay, not every, half the countries in the world. I think it's like 190 countries in the world. But whatever it is, it's a huge representation. It fills up the Vancouver Conference Center. And it was really good. You know, like 2 years ago, I was there and there was a lot of excitement about new technologies. But I was going to say, you know, what was really cool was that increasingly I've seen greater representation from all energy systems. You know, historically, it's largely been renewable energy and that constituency. But increasingly, I mean, there was a lot of representation from the oil and gas industry, from the nuclear industry. In fact, I encourage our listeners to go online, and we'll put the link to this online, because I moderated a panel that had Steve Lott, Executive Vice Chair of CNRL. We also had José Gabor, who was the CEO of Evolution. That's Brookfield's arm of Canadian Renewable Energy. And we had John Gorman from the Canadian Nuclear Association, and also Catherine Abreu. She's the CEO of the Climate Action Network. And so we had a spirited discussion on stage about whether or not renewables are the only answer to addressing the aggressive climate action goals that have been set out not only in the world, but here in Canada. And so no spoiler alerts here. You can go online and check out that debate. That's well worth viewing.
You were the moderator.
I was a moderator, but it's well worth viewing because it was just a really good discussion, and how each primary energy source is viewing the world in terms of addressing these sustainability issues.
Well, it would be interesting because often each of these groups goes to their own meetings and talk amongst themselves. And that's one thing I really loved about Globe. I wasn't able to go this year, but in the past few I've gone to, is that you're actually getting everyone in Canada and even a bit beyond, but from all these different areas in one place. And so you get some pretty unique conversations. Yeah. So I'm glad that we can share that with some of our audience that wasn't able to go.
Okay, so coronavirus.
Coronavirus. All right. So we did write a couple weeks ago the implications for oil and gas, and we wrote that there'll be more questions than answers for some time, and that continues to be the case. But we wanted to talk a little bit about it on the podcast as well. It is different than SARS in many ways. There's actually already more deaths than SARS, and SARS really was active for about 6 months, so it seems to be spreading faster. There was news this week that the rate of infections, the daily new cases, was slowing, and that was good, but we found out today.
That was until yesterday or something.
Yeah, there was a reporting issue, and now they've had a big surge up in the rate of new cases because of the way they were accounting for them. So it doesn't seem like things are slowing down here.
No, it's very disturbing, of course, to see it. And of course, to quarantine the second largest economy in the world also means that you are having a major impact on the global economy, let alone the Chinese economy, which is so consequential to the energy landscape.
Yeah, and I mean, there was an economic impact from SARS, but this could be much larger because China is so much more important today than it was back then. In 2003, China's impact on the energy markets was much different than today. So back then, their oil demand was half of what it is today. Their global GDP is 16% of the world right now, where it was 4% back then. So, you know, a quarantine of China, and by the way, we didn't really have a full quarantine back then either, so this is different as well, is going to have a bigger impact on China, but also the global economy as it did back then.
Well, SARS affected Toronto quite a bit at that time as well. So fortunately, it appears as though the diseases or the virus is largely contained within China. There are, of course, instances around the world. But we shall see. The real point is that as the second largest economy in the world, and some parts of it is coming to a halt. Many of the upstream supply chains are compromised in terms of their ability to output. And as is the case with any sort of disruption in the economy, there's a few months before the lags kick in. You know, there's a lagged effect.
But when it comes to oil demand, especially Chinese oil demand, the data is quite lagged. So that is one issue. But there's no shortage of analysts that are trying to predict what they think might be the effect.
Yeah, what are the estimates in terms of how much we're losing in terms of the consumption of energy?
Well, I would say that there's a big range because of the uncertainty, right? But there's some that are saying on an annual basis, we could lose anywhere between 200,000 on the low side and as high as 500,000 barrels a day on the high side. Now, we believe that global demand growth based on the economic outlooks this year would have been about 1 million barrels a day.
So half of it could
be. On the high side, we're halving it. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, just today, the IEA came out with their monthly oil report. So I definitely read that first thing this morning to see what they would say. And they're saying about a 400,000 barrel a day drop. So they're not too far off the high side right now.
Okay, but let's just to be clear. So this is not, at least not yet, a drop in total consumption. It's a drop in the growth estimate year over year.
Yeah, so we were, and by the way, the IEA had a higher growth estimate, but in general, most forecasts are about 1 million barrels a day of growth.
Okay,
so. And so we're saying we're going to half that, but there'll still be some growth, but it's going to be less than what
we thought. Okay, again, perspective. So we're ballpark 101 million barrels per day.
Yep.
And by the end of 2020, that was conjectured to go up to, say, 102. But now we're only going to go up to 101.5 potentially, if it's a 500,000 barrel a day forfeiture of demand. But that's hugely consequential because even a couple 100,000 barrels a day has a huge impact at the margins on the impact on price.
Right. Well, because this is happening with a backdrop of over 2 million barrels a day of non-OPEC growth that's entering the market this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so we already had quite a big oversupply because too much growth was coming on.
Let me just interrupt again. The non-OPEC, so that means the countries that are not curtailing their productions, led by the Saudi Arabias and the Middle Eastern countries and their friends, the Russians and others, not those.
That's right.
Countries.
This is a lot of this growth is coming from offshore projects like in Norway, Guyana, Brazil, even some Canadian growth because.
Right.
As we get rail moving up, we're going to get some growth.
And, of course, the U.S. is not.
The U.S. is growing as well. But the U.S. is one of five as opposed to the last few years where it's been primarily U.S. growth.
Right. So what's the estimate of the growth of that non-OPEC group this year?
It's about 2.5 million barrels a day of growth. And compared to 0.5 now million barrels a day of demand growth. So we've got quite a lot of oversupply.
Right. So somebody's going to have to curtail and cut, assuming that the coronavirus really impacts global economy and demand.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the IEA today came out with a chart that's quite interesting that shows how much OPEC is actually producing in Q1 of 2020 and how much they should if they wanted to balance the market, what the call on OPEC would be. There's almost a 2 million barrel a day delta here. So basically, you know how OPEC was talking about potentially making a 0.6 million barrel a day cut? The IEA is saying it has to be closer to 2 million barrels a day before we'd get this market balanced.
Right. And the OPEC group puts out how much?
They're producing around 29 million barrels
29,
a day.
So they got to cut. They got to basically cut 2 million barrels a day. So, I mean,
this on top of the fact they're already cutting 1.7 million barrels a day versus where they were before they started this.
Right.
So, you know, that's the big question here. Will OPEC, you know, back in the time of the financial crisis, OPEC came in hard and they said, okay, we are going to stop the price of oil from dropping. We know there's a lot of uncertainty. They actually made a commitment to cut over 4 million barrels a day, and that helped prop up oil prices. It doesn't seem from this first meeting that they just had that they're in that mindset, at least yet.
Right. So they've got a really tough set of decisions to make. Are they meeting anytime soon?
Well, there was a technical meeting last week, and there's talk that there may be a meeting. The interesting thing is these monthly updates, OPEC also puts out their own. And they had a fairly small impact to demand in theirs. So they are, you know, the range of analysts out there, they are saying that the demand impact isn't nearly as great as some others, like the IEA. So again, there's more questions than answers here when it comes to what's going on with the real oil demand number. And that's part of the challenge.
There seems a lot of questions also on the supply side in terms of not only what is the increase in American production. There's still some question marks around that. And on the supply side, how much OPEC is going to cut. So it's a very dynamic situation, but the indicators as a consequence of this, we'll call it a black swan event, you know, sort of a unexpected event from left field, the coronavirus, that it's going to potentially really suggest a probability of price pressure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, before this, you would have had a view of higher prices than you do now. And we'll just have to find out. You know, one thing the market doesn't like is uncertainty.
Yeah.
And the psychology of the market really does affect the price.
Right.
But I'm more concerned if these numbers are right and we start seeing inventory builds over the next few months, that's the real data that will start to really weigh down the market.
But you would agree that the market is still in a wait-and-see mode. Like, we're not really seeing a wholesale sell-off yet.
I mean, the price of oil is still $50, right?
Yeah,
and if you believe that the level of oversupply that's shown in this IEA report, you would think the price would be lower because it's trying to incent people to stop producing at that point. So I think what we'll need to see over the course of the next 2, 3, 4 months, because it, as you say, the data's lagged, when we start to see how the inventory levels are building, that will kind of give people some evidence about how oversupplied the market is. So more to come, but definitely not a good thing in terms of what it means for price.
Not only oil, right? I mean, there's natural gas side. The LNG market is being hammered because China doesn't need as much LNG either.
Yeah, it's surprising. China is actually about 17% of all of the LNG used in the world. And LNG markets globally, especially the spot market, was already suffering because there's been a lot of new supply added from the United States and Australia. And what that's done is drove the spot prices in the international market to levels we've never seen before.
Right,
so we've got about $4 per MMBTU, that's US dollar per MMBTU in Asia right now. And in Europe, it's closer to $3. That's crazy. Like, those are North American gas prices in markets that typically
historically,
in the past were $10.
$10, yeah. So, I mean, the whole world at the moment is got too much liquefied natural gas in the marketplace. And the spot market, just for our audience, is the market that is sort of like the immediate market that is not contracted. Like many of these LNG tankers have long-term contracts, like for example, a deal between the seller and the buyer that you will take a cargo of LNG every so many days or months for 10 years and the price is fixed or is linked to some benchmark like Japanese oil prices.
Yeah, and I actually found in a Forbes article the oil-based contracts, so these long-term contracts, dominate the market at about 70% of all contracts.
70. So 30% is the spot market that actually trades in a very immediate free market sense.
Right. And may go at these very low prices that we're talking about right now. So yes, a lot of LNG does not sell that way. But anyway, why does this matter for North America? In the past, we were isolated from international markets, but things have really changed. LNG feed gas is now over 9 BCF per day of demand in North America.
Right.
Up from about 5 BCF per day this time last year. So all those US LNG facilities, which have contributed to the oversupply, now we're kind of dependent on that demand here in North America. And there's concerns that these types of prices, are we going to see that LNG not be shipped out at the rate it is right now?
Well, what's fascinating from a like a decade-long perspective, actually maybe 10 to 15 years, is the impact, first of all, of U.S. shale gas, then followed by the shale oils, tight oils, all a consequence of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. And it's just amazing to look at the supply growth in the United States and even here in Canada, but especially the United States, and what that did, first of all, to our domestic North American markets. And now it's really impacting the global markets.
Yeah, it's like the it's spreading like a virus. We had low prices here, and now they're starting to hit the international markets.
Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show you the transition. You know, we talk about energy transition, and immediately what comes into people's minds is transition to renewables and so on. But actually, the biggest transition has been within the oil and gas industry, the shift to new oil production from the shale oils, tight oils, and the shale gas. You know, little known fact that the growth on an energy basis, like on a joules basis in shale gas, has been the same almost as the global growth in joules of renewable energy.
Wow. All and you don't see it that way.
All installations.
Yeah, wow. Well, it's because it's replacing the conventional, so
right.
the absolute growth hasn't been as much.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. You know, we're talking about prices in North America, hard to believe.
Yeah.
I'm sure people will remember these days and reminisce, but we used to have like $8 prices just in North America.
Right.
And here, you'd never dream of $8, but you certainly wouldn't dream of $3 international prices either.
Yeah, and that's why the impetus has been over the last several years on that whole cost discipline. To be able to withstand these sorts of price pressures that just seem to keep coming one after the other as a consequence of the new technologies on the supply side, liberating more oil and gas at progressively lower prices, and the demand shock potential, as we've seen from the coronavirus.
Okay, well, let's focus in on Canada now and rail. So there's a number of topics here to talk about. First of all, this blockade that started last weekend. And what has happened is we've got people that are blockading rail lines. And I myself learned a lot this week about this. I did not know that, you know, we have rail lines that connect Eastern Canada and Western Canada. You know, there's just one rail line that connects it. So if that thing is shut down, there's no propane getting to Quebec.
You didn't study the last spike in school?
Well, I expected we expanded it after that. I didn't know it was still just one rail line.
Yeah, that's the pan-Canadian rail line.
Yeah, it's one.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised by that. And then the other major blockade, there are others, but the two big ones is this one between Toronto and Montreal, and then this one near Prince Rupert. And it's really slowing down, almost grinding to a halt, rail movements
all
in Canada.
All of which is to say there aren't a lot of alternative lines if one is blocked.
Yes, I didn't realize that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you've got stories that rail cars are being parked on the track and backing up, you know, over big parts of this country over these protests.
Well, so this goes beyond an energy security issue because we have even propane cars headed east.
Yeah, they're saying that there'll be no propane to Quebec here, where there is right now, and then over the course, just like with those strikes that we had earlier or at the end of the year, that we could have no propane in Quebec and no grain going to ports in Prince Rupert.
Right. So broadly, I mean, the resource security issue as much as it is an energy security issue.
Yeah, you know, we always talk about energy security, but this whole thing made me think, wow, like, we have a lot of dependence on these rail lines for getting goods across the country.
And we only have one.
Yeah. So
east to west.
We'll talk about the oil market implications because, as many of you know, Western Canada depends more and more on crude by rail.
Mm-hmm.
The last data point from the regulator was that we were moving about 300,000 barrels a day of crude by rail. And this comes at a time, oddly enough, on February 6th, this is the Friday, about the same time that these protests started, when the government ordered that trains slow down because there was a derailment of a crude by rail car in Saskatchewan.
Yeah, the second one, I think it was in the same place.
Yeah, and so what they said on Friday is that all trains that are carrying hazardous goods up to a certain level need to cut their speed in half.
Wow.
So that would mean that if we were moving 300,000 barrels a day before, then we'd be moving 150,000. Because the reality is, if the train has to go half as fast, that means you can't move any more than half as much, right?
So, but I mean, to be clear, that restriction has conditions attached to the train based on what hazardous goods they're hauling, not just oil and gas, but things like chlorine and what have you, right?
So it's 20 cars of substances, including oil, but chlorine, I understand you only need one car.
Right. But because there are only so many routes, and you know the main east-west one is one route, that means that if you slow down one, you slow everything down, just like a traffic jam.
It's kind of like driving your car down the highway. If you know most people have to go half the speed, you really can't do much, especially if you can't pass them.
So a very serious situation.
Well, and the other concern is, you know, as this goes on, we're basically creating a backlog in the rail system,
right?
Where all these goods and things need to be moved. So not only will we have the backlog, but then when things get going and we can only move the rail at half the speed, it's going to take a lot longer to clear that backlog.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what are the implications for Western Canadian crude oil? I mean, there's just so many implications for the economy at large if this thing carries on.
Yeah, like I saw a number yesterday, like $1 billion a day is being transported of goods in general, by rail.
Okay.
So there's definitely broader implications for the economy. What does it mean for crude oil markets? Well, it means that we're going to move potentially, if this speed limit stays in place, only 150,000 barrels a day of crude.
Yeah, but don't most of those crude barrels go south from Alberta into Montana.
But the fact that the bottleneck, it's like you've created a bottleneck at the top that they can only move so fast. So it's going to cut into the capacity significantly. And at the same time, we actually have very high inventory levels now in Western Canada because of that Keystone outage earlier last year. That means that, it's not looking good, right? We do need the crude by rail in order to clear the market because the inventory levels are high.
Okay. So it's a serious situation. I can't imagine that the government is going to allow it to last much longer. We won't get into the whole politics of the whole situation because that would take up three podcasts worth of discussion and a few glasses or if not bottles of wine. So let's talk about post clear up of the situation, the rail contracts that the government of Alberta sold to various parties recently.
Yeah, so that was the other big news around crude by rail. The Notley government signed up to these rail contracts for 120,000 barrels a day of capacity. They were supposed to...
That was back in 2000, late 18?
Yeah, it was quite a long time ago. It takes a long time because they actually have to go get the cars and there's a lot of pieces to it.
So actually, let's just go back to that time period, okay? Because that was a time period where we just had this backing up of crude. We had the massively wide price discounts. So wide.
The curtailment
that,
went on.
It's so wide that not only was it affecting the heavy oil markets, but the very light oil markets, which affected the broad base of drillers across the entire West. And so at that time, the then Notley government decided to buy rail contracts because the situation had to be eased over time. We did not want a repeat of this sort of thing. And also recognizing that there's a lag between the time that you put your order in for railroad cars and the time that they get delivered and the contracts can be fulfilled would take a while. Then the UCP came in, I think it was in May of last year, claiming free markets should dictate how all this should work, decided to put the contracts up for sale to the private sector. And so recently, what happened?
Well, the announcement this week was that a total of 19 contracts for the rail cars and the loading and unloading capacity and logistics and other services. So they were finally able to get 19 companies to buy all of that. It took quite a long time. I think the expectation was that this would be done sooner. Now, they're not making the companies known, so we don't know who bought the rail capacity. But from my perspective, the good news is, from an oil market perspective, is we've had this capacity. Some of it was available in the summer. The rest of it was supposed to be available, you know, at the end of this year. And we haven't been using it. And so from the perspective of assuming, and I know we will get these rail issues solved that we have at this moment, we will need this rail capacity to move crude out of Western Canada. We have a lot of pent-up supply. There is demand for rail. So it's great news that this capacity is going to be available in these 19 different contracts. I don't know if they're owned by 19 different companies, but whoever they are, they will want to get a return on those and start moving the crude by rail. We can move more crude out of the province the more rail cars we have. And so I think...
And ease the bottleneck. And then as we lean into the Line 3 and TMX and all that stuff in future, then there's sort of a bridge to all this capacity that's coming in future so that we don't have to curtail our production and that we hopefully shield ourselves from those eras of wide price discounts that contribute to billions of dollars of revenue loss.
That's exactly it. You know, if we had this additional crude by rail, not just the government's, but the other capacity that's been added since, we wouldn't have had those blowouts to the extent that we did in the last quarter. And, you know, it's possible, I hate to even say this, but it's possible those pipelines get a bit delayed and that we'll need this rail longer. And so it's good that we have this asset. It's kind of like insurance, you know, that we have a way to move our crude to market if pipelines aren't there. Now we're finding today that sometimes crude by rail can be delayed too. But we're hoping that the blockades and all this situation will get cleared and then we'll be able to move all that crude out of the province.
I think we can make a safe prediction and there's always going to be something that's going to be antagonizing the markets. Whether it's domestically or globally. It seems that the trajectory of easing the Western Canadian oil glut is going in the right direction.
That's right. Getting more capacity is good. And so it's good to see that these rail cars are going to come in to the mix, be commercial, and start moving crude.
Okay. So what about Enbridge, now that we're still on the topic of pipelines and basically market access?
Right. So we talked about this in earlier podcasts. So just to remind everyone, Enbridge has a plan that they would like to contract the Enbridge mainline. Today, The Enbridge Mainline moves 70% of the crude oil out of Western Canada. It's the biggest pipeline we have. And it is open to everyone, and there's no one that has the rights to ship on it. So every month people bid in, you know, what they would like to move on it. And there's a process that's been going on for 70 years.
That's called common carrier because it's open to the commons.
Yeah. Well, and it, you know, all our systems are supposed to be common carrier, but the fact that they don't have firm contracts is unique.
Okay.
And they would like to contract it so that people sign up to have the rights to that capacity anywhere between 8 to 20 years. They had an open season this summer. The Canadian Energy Regulator stepped in.
Open season is like a bidding.
Yes, like an open season to go out to people and say, would you be willing to sign on to having this capacity over that kind of time period? Right. Now, there were a lot of concerns about this raised by the producer community, and they went to the Canadian Energy Regulator. There was a bit of a process this summer into the fall, and it was decided to put the open season on hold so people didn't have to sign contracts and to have a hearing.
Right.
And so the big news, you know, now is that the Canadian Energy Regulator in January came out asking for people to comment on the process that they would like for this hearing. And I think these are pretty administrative type right. asks, but there's a lot of interest in this topic. And so there was a lot of letters written, and many of the letters expressed their concerns. And there were some supportive letters,
too. So those letters are public, aren't they?
Yes, you can go to the Canadian Energy Regulator site. There's actually an area where you can see everything associated with this, and people like me like to read that sort of thing.
Do you want to publish
that? Yeah, I can post a post to that.
In case somebody's getting difficulty to sleep.
Yeah, you can read these. I actually find them interesting.
Okay.
You might keep you up. But so my count, and I've seen different numbers out there, is that there was about 40 letters that said that they were against contracting. And about 8 letters that were supportive. And normally, and you don't necessarily put in evidence at this point, but there's some people that really wanted to get out their points. So there's actually a fair amount of data and stuff in the letters in terms of people's concerns. Many of the people that were against contracting asked for a 2-part hearing, which would be a little bit different than what's typically done, saying, you know, we should fundamentally look at, should we even contract this pipeline at all? Because we think that considering the circumstances we're in today, short pipe capacity, very few options for producers, we should look at the fundamental question
but
first. And then Enbridge wrote back and said they want just one hearing. So there will be a hearing. It will happen this year. But the question is, will there be one hearing on everything or will there be 2 parts? So the timeline would look quite different depending on what path we went down.
I sort of like the Netflix model of 2 episodes, you know.
I do too. Okay. And many of the producers do. By the way, I just wanted to put some numbers. I tallied up the folks that were against contracting or expressed that in their letters, that equals 60% of Western Canadian crude oil production, which totals to 2.7 million barrels a day of production. Meanwhile, Enbridge has used a number that 70% of their shippers, or 1.9 million barrels a day, support
right.
it. So the opposition is quite large in terms
right.
of just pure volume.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there'll be more to come on this topic, and I think this will be something that will be part of what's discussed over the coming year.
Okay. So the Canadian Energy Regulator is going to rule on this. These one or two hearings or episodes, as I like to call them, and that we should stay tuned. I think we're done.
Yeah, that's it. All right. Well, we've covered a lot. Thanks for joining our podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.